Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and a little over 100 years ago, in February of 1914, the industrialist Andrew Carnegie started an organization whose goal it was to put an end to war forever through rational principles of international law. Reality check. World War I began just 6 months later. Tomorrow is that 100th anniversary of the start of World War I. The painful lesson caused Carnegie's organization to adjust its focus ever since to the human dimensions of conflict, including less rational ones like honor, self-interest, and fear. On the occasion of the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I, let's talk to the current president of the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs, Joel Rosenthal. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
And by way of biographical background, the industrialist Andrew Carnegie, mostly a steel magnate, I guess, had two main philanthropic goals in his life: the proliferation of libraries and to achieve world peace through international law. What was his thinking about world peace before World War I?
Very interesting question. His idea of peace really grew out of his experience actually with the Civil War. He had not been in the Civil War as a participant, but he had observed it up close.
Because he was already 80 when World War I started.
That's correct.
79 or 80.
Right. He died in 1919, so he was well advanced in age by the time the war started. But he had seen the Civil War, and he had seen industrial war, and he had seen what the sort of combination of industry, machine, the massing of troops, the effect on civilians, the idea of total war. And as a rationalist, he thought that this is something that the world will evolve away from. Just as we've evolved away from slavery, just as we've evolved away from, and this was one of his favorite examples, dueling, which he called private war. That these were crazy ideas. These were ideas of sort of a barbaric civilization. And his view was that civilization was progressing in some way.
The fact that war broke out, World War I broke out, just months after he started the Carnegie Council, did he feel like a failure personally when the war began?
He did. It broke his heart. In fact, the beginning of World War I is really his exit from the world stage. Carnegie had a very interesting persona. He was the Bill Gates of the early 20th century. Everybody knew who he was. Everybody thought of him as the richest man in the world.
Bill Gates in terms of leading a movement to give away a lot of your fortune.
Right, and that's the next thing, right, which is philanthropy. He had devoted the last third of his life to giving away his fortune. And he was one of the pioneers of the idea of philanthropy as we understand it today. He made a very important distinction between charity and philanthropy.
What's the distinction?
And the distinction is charity is the relief of immediate human suffering. People need to eat. They need to be clothed. They need housing, etc., natural disasters and so on. Philanthropy was something beyond that. And it was to think in bold and creative ways about how we live our lives, what kind of institutions are available to us. And a philanthropist will invest in actually changing patterns of life. And so you mentioned public libraries as a good example. This was a profound idea, to give access to books and information to every person everywhere free. This is what he meant by philanthropy, and peace followed. He thought that given his progressive view, that the world was evolving in a certain way, and it was up to him to invest in it. And we take for granted now many of the things that Carnegie was investing in, which is international law and organization, that there can be some set of rules, some set of principles, and some institutions that can help to guide to a more peaceful world.
My guest is Joel Rosenthal, president of the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs, with whom we are marking the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of World War I. That 100th anniversary generally seemed to be August 1st, right?
That's correct. We actually had a public symposium in Sarajevo at the end of June, June 27, 28, which marked the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, which is generally thought of as the sort of the beginning event which set into motion kind of a slow motion crisis, the crisis of 1914, which really went through July. Some of you will remember from your high school history lessons the famous blank check and ultimatum and so on. But hostilities begin virtually this week, 100 years ago in Europe.
So, listeners, can rationalism ever top nationalism? 212-433-WNYC or anything else around this that you want to discuss with Joel Rosenthal? 212-433-9692. And you've spoken about some ethical principles worth revisiting as we think about the 100th anniversary. Tolerance for difference, self-determination. And is the third one the ability to learn from history?
That's correct. Right. So in Sarajevo, it gave us a moment to sort of think hard about, you know, what principles were sort of set into motion at that time and how we're doing now and how they relate to current events. And the three that you mentioned presented themselves. The first is pluralism. And if you look at conflict in the world today, what you see is the failure of pluralism. It's a hostility to difference and an inability to live with differences. And from my perspective, the word ethics, as much as it is about consensus and trying to figure out how to live together in a positive way, it's also how to live with differences. It's sort of I have sometimes a minimalist view of ethics. So tolerance is perhaps a good way to think about that. It's related
minimalist to the view of ethics, meaning we can only aspire to tolerate, not to love.
Well, sometimes, yeah. I mean, I think if you're talking about this in a global context, I think that Carnegie himself had a little bit of overreach. And so sometimes it's very difficult to determine together what the good is or what the good life is because it may be irreconcilable differences. However, I do think that we can agree on what's wrong. And that's what I mean by minimalist. So my view of ethics is perhaps a little bit less ambitious than Carnegie's.
And even at that, it's much easier said than done. We can
exactly
say tolerance and self-determination till we're blue in the face.
Right.
But I think no one is more surprised than secular Westerners when they see the persistence of hyper-nationalism or group religious fervor at the level that can lead to war.
Right.
So can you measure it if it's at least less? Do we have less of it than we did 100 years ago?
Good question. I'm not sure I can measure it. I can refer you to a book by Steven Pinker called The Better Angels of Our Nature. The subtitle is interesting. It's called Why Violence Has Declined. And Pinker makes an empirical argument, an evidence-based argument, that we are doing a little bit better. And the reason that we're doing better is that norms or principles have evolved in a progressive way. Now, this is contested, but I think it's an important contribution to our thinking and certainly worth revisiting. From our perspective at the Carnegie Council, we want to keep that kind of issue front and center, our tagline, Ethics Matter.
We have a full board of calls. Let's see
right.
what people
sure.
have to say
sure.
or to ask. Bob in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bob.
Hi there. This is a very interesting topic. And, you know, what I wanted to say is that, of course, it's very difficult to control religion and religious fanaticism because, of course, if you feel you have God on your side, then you can do anything you want. There are inherent flaws in the human race. Why would a million people be hacked by their neighbors in Rwanda with machetes, hacked to death? You know, there's something inherently wrong with human beings, and, you know, we're trying to work at changing it. Religion was supposed to change it, but religion's been the cause of more war than probably anything else. But one thing that wasn't mentioned that I'd like to mention is that, especially in a world where half of the people are suffering with poverty, disease, hunger, one of the things that wasn't mentioned was really the inequality of income. People, when they're satisfied with their life, tend not to want to go to war, I would think. But Carnegie, even Carnegie himself, we have this the oligarchs in America giving us, foundations and libraries and building museums, and at the same time, labor unions and their workers on strike. example would be the burning to death of strikers in the Southwest against the mining interests. You know, at the same time, we're getting lovely museums.
Right. So, Bob, I'm going to leave it there to get some other people on,
sure. But
we need to deal with the poverty issue.
Right. No, I think that's a very, very important issue, and it's part of the work of the Carnegie Council. I think we do need to think systemically about the institutions in which we live. And the Carnegie question would be, can we do better? Ethics is conventionally thought about how we make choices on the individual level, but we also need to take a step back and think about the rules, the norms, and so on of the institutions in which we live.
And this
goes to inequality.
And of human behavior, which the caller was very pessimistic about,
right.
Kind of human nature.
Right.
And I noticed that in the speech you gave recently that next to your three ethical principles, which we talked about, self-determination, tolerance, learning from history, which might sound idealistic, you cite Thucydides' classic framing of things that motivate human beings more automatically.
Right.
Honor, self-interest, and fear.
Right.
And you can plug that right into practically any war in the world.
Right.
Ukraine, Russia, Israel, Gaza, pick your one and
right. Fill
in the specifics for those folks. Honor, self-interest, and fear.
Right.
Pre-rational.
Right. And these are the things, of course, but again, they may be pre-rational, but I still think we can reflect on them in a rational way. And let me just give you one way to do that. Perhaps very simple, but something often overlooked, and I think encapsulated in those three ideas, is the idea that we all act on our self-interest as individuals and as a country, national interest. And we see that as proper, appropriate, and correct. We should act in our own interests. However, to understand our self-interest, we have to understand the interests of other people. Again, a simple point often overlooked, and it gets to the idea of honor. It gets to the idea of fear. So in order to understand our own interests correctly and to act in an ethical way, one simple idea is to make the effort to fully understand the interests of other people.
So maybe history is a race between honor, self-interest, and fear on one
right. Side
and tolerance, self-determination, and the ability to learn from history on the other.
Correct. And I actually think one of the best modern speeches on this problem actually was given by President Obama in 2009 when he received the Nobel Lecture. I don't want to conflate this with the Obama foreign policy. I'm just looking at the text of the lecture itself, where he talks about
and he won the Nobel Peace Prize before he ever had a foreign policy, but that's another story.
Right, but I guess I would submit that again, without making a political point or talking about the policy, just from an academic perspective, from an ideas perspective, that he cites this problem that peace is a moral imperative. However, it gets challenged in the ways that you're describing.
And Bob in are you in Dover? Is that where you are?
Yes, indeed.
Hi, Bob.
Dover, New Jersey.
Hi, Bob.
Hi. The three initial principles, tolerance and self-determination, strike me as being mutually exclusive in large parts of the world. Self-determination in certain Middle Eastern countries is going to result in virtual slavery for half of the population, women. And I don't, you know, how does that compute with your thesis that these three ethical principles are universal?
Well, I think they are in competition, and this is a problem. What I would say is that I think we could make the assessment that self-determination works in some places as a modus vivendi, as a way of different people living together with differences. But I would agree with you that there's no formula to work this out. One of the legacies of World War I was the full-throated launching of the principle of self-determination by Woodrow Wilson and by the United States without thinking through exactly how this would be implemented in places where ethnic groups are mixed, in places where it would be very difficult to implement, in addition to the point that the caller's making, which is that you know, there may be some communities that will self-determine in a way that we find difficult to accept.
And there's always going to be this tension between universal ideas of human rights and ideas of tolerance of plurality.
Right.
Pluralism.
Right. And what we're trying to do is to generate a rational, reasonable, open conversation around those principles that we believe are common in the human experience. That's not to say that we're going to agree with what they are, but that when you say ethics, it's very interesting. Even the concept of ethics is universal, and it invites a global conversation.
Huh. And you mentioned Woodrow Wilson. I read a take from the Cato Institute, very non-interventionist group, that President Woodrow Wilson made the 20th century worse by getting the United States involved in World War I, that without us, the European sides would have fought to roughly a draw and would have had to end it with a muddling through kind of compromise. But with the U.S., we destroyed and humiliated Germany, setting the stage for the rise of Hitler, thus World War II, and the Holocaust. Are you familiar with that theory?
I am. I mean, that's sort of almost a conventional at this point understanding of the conclusion of World War I, which that it was a victor's peace, which sowed the seeds for what followed. And getting to your theme about learning from history, I think this is very important. And one of the things that I think we can derive as a general principle, making the point of understanding the interests of others, is the poisonous quality of victor's peace.
Did Andrew Carnegie, with his goal of ending war, support U.S. entry into World War I?
He was not. If my recollection, he was not public about that. It was right at the end of his life. He had great hopes for Wilson, and he made a point how Wilson had Scotch blood in him. He was a Scotsman from his ancestry, and Carnegie, having been born in Scotland, felt some kinship. Carnegie, though, was
a little nationalism.
A little nationalism. Oh, it was there. There were a lot of paradoxes with Mr. Carnegie, but the idea was that Carnegie's passion was to he had funded the building of the Peace Palace at The Hague. He believed that great powers over time would act like litigants in lawsuits, so that when there was a dispute between great powers, they would bring it to the court for mediation and arbitration. He was also a believer in the League of Nations. And so he placed great hope in Wilson to help to get the United States to that point. My sense is that if he felt the war could end with that as the result, which is an enhanced League of Nations and World Court, that Carnegie may have supported it.
Carol on the Lower East Side, you're on WNYC. Hello. Carol, you there?
Hello, this is Carol, yes.
Go ahead.
Hi. I'm looking at the op-ed Saturday, July 19th in the New York Times. Timothy Egan writes an article called Faith-Based Fanatics. And in it, he writes, it's not true that all wars are fought in the name of religion. Of the 1,723 armed conflicts documented in the three-volume Encyclopedia of Wars, only 123, or less than 7%, involved a religious cause.
So we overemphasize the role of religion in war, you're saying?
We often do, yeah.
I think there's something to that. I think that my preferred way of analyzing these conflicts are competitions about power, competitions about interest. And I think that religion is frequently used cynically in a manipulative fashion by leaders to pursue power and interest.
And also, sometimes I think conflicts get misunderstood as religious conflicts when they're really conflicts over resources and oppression. Sunnis versus Shiites in Iraq,
correct,
not to talk so much about today, but when Saddam Hussein was in power, his Sunni group, which was a minority in Iraq, had all the power over the Shiite majority.
Right.
And that had consequences for people's economic lives and everything else, and led to resentment. But then we call it Shiite versus Sunni.
Right. And to get back to what you – I like your phrase of pre-rational thinking. Religion uses that to instill fear, to instill questions about honor, and to get to people's basic identity of who they think they are and what they stand for. And so – again, it's a mixed picture, but I think that it's sometimes helpful to think about religion from a realpolitik perspective rather than one that accepts the idea that religion is the motivating force.
One more call. Tedla in Flushing, you're on WNYC. Hey, Tedla.
Yeah, good morning, Brian. For me, I see all wars, it is either somebody's war and someone doesn't care. If you go to World War, I wonder if Africans or Asians were worried about that war. Now, in our time, we see conflicts all over the world. Had 9/11 was not happening here in the United States, we would never have involved in big time, go to Iraq and do a lot of crazy things. And now when I see it, when there is a conflict in the Middle East, as long as we are not there, we are not touched by this, we don't care. So that means we human beings, we don't know, we don't have this rationale to live in peace, harmony. We don't have it. We fight in our local community. We fight in every minor thing. So for me, where is peace? I don't understand. I mean, we are living in this war, and I think humanity will go on forever fighting, maybe in small scale, large scale. I don't know, but I'm afraid that war is part of us.
Well, I think that you raise a profound point. And the one thing I would say, an open question, is there, to use a phrase from the philosopher Peter Singer at Princeton, he talks about the expanding circle. And what he's referring to is the expanding circle of empathy. This is a question about globalization. And I phrase it as a question, not as an answer. But are we more attuned as a process of globalization to the pain and suffering of others? And if so, does it mean anything? These are all questions our council raises.
We did a series a few years ago with the author of a book called The End of War.
Right.
And he actually convinced me that the good guys are winning,
mm-hmm.
if you look at the really big time frame of history,
mm-hmm.
that people waged war more easily just to get more stuff
mm-hmm.
for themselves
mm-hmm.
in the deep past. The breaks on that of democracy
right.
and non-aggression are learned ethics
exactly.
that are much more prevalent than, say, 1,000 years ago. Now governments at least have to have a pretext, like the caller
right.
was saying. You were saying religion is a pretext. The governments have to at least have a pretext of self-defense.
Right.
Before going to war most of the time.
Right. I couldn't agree with that more. And the idea that these ethical principles actually matter, as you say, a pretext that they have to be addressed. And again, maybe that's just a small beginning, but it's something. And I think that it's better than the alternative, which is to really be sort of nihilistic about it and say that principles don't matter at all.
On the occasion of the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I, we thank Joel Rosenthal, president of the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, movie critic Ken Turan with his top 54 of all time. And we'll ask you to nominate number 55. Stay tuned.